Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
3, 2, 1. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We're going to talk to two men of uncommon intelligence, both hailing from the great state of Georgia. In the course of this program, I'm pleased to say, first, Representative Jody Heiss, the current representative of the 10th District in Congress of Georgia, and the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich, will be joining us later in the program. It's a delight to have a chance to catch up with a man who brings a powerful ministry to his job as the representative of the people of the 10th District of Georgia. Jody Heiss is a doctor of ministry, among other things. He is a member of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform and the ranking Republican member of its Government Operations Subcommittee. He has also thrown his hat in the ring, a man in the arena, as they say, to be the next Secretary of State of Georgia. And we're going to be talking with him about why that is, the sort of backdrop to his interest in taking on that responsibility, specifically what has been happening to and with election integrity in his state and across the country. Congressman Heiss, it is a delight to have you with us, sir. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Frank, I can't tell you how great it is to be back with you, and thanks for all you do.
Let's start, if we may, with the 2020 election. Georgia was a swing state, a key state, arguably, and there has been considerable evidence that it was not a free and fair election. I know you've expressed concerns about what happened in your state. How would you characterize what went on and the magnitude of the impact of it?
Well, it was an absolute disaster. I mean, there really is no other way to describe what happened in Georgia's election process in 2020. From the very beginning, it was a disaster. Back in March of 2020, myself and other members of the Republican Georgia delegation from Washington, we had a conference call with Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, and we urged him back in March not to send out absentee ballot requests to everyone on the voter registration file. The voter registration file, not only in Georgia, but in virtually every state, is a minimum of 5% inaccurate, and in many instances, well in excess of 10% inaccurate. And that is believed to be the case in Georgia. So look, Frank, you have 7 million...
And that's before you even get to the question of the problem of mail-in ballots, which a former governor of Georgia and president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, among others, warned was fraught with fraud, no?
Absolutely. And that was just the beginning of the issue. But when you have like 7 million registered voters in the state of Georgia, and you have 7% or 10% of the registration file inaccurate, that means 700,000 potential ballot requests were sent to illegal voters in Georgia. And that's how it all started. And so we had hundreds of thousands of illegal voters who received an application to receive a live ballot. And then there's no voter ID associated with those ballots. So we had hundreds of thousands like that.
There's another piece to this backstory that I want to make sure we cover with you, Congressman Jody Heiss, and that is the role played by Stacey Abrams with your Secretary of State, Raffensperger. Remind us who she is and what went on that, I guess, countermanded the strong recommendation that you and your colleagues made to the Secretary of State back in March of last year.
Yeah, you know, she is, of course, everyone knows Stacey Abrams now. She is a former representative in the Georgia General Assembly and has gone on to become a major mover and player. She ran for governor a couple of years ago, still to this day, has not accepted the fact that she lost her bid for governor, but that's set her on a path of trying to transform the voter election process in Georgia, and unfortunately,
fundamentally transform, you might say.
Fundamentally change it, yeah. And you kind of had a perfect storm, and COVID was used as the excuse for her and her cohorts to put enormous pressure on Brad Raffensperger to change the way we do elections in Georgia. And I would mind you, he has no authority to change election laws, but unilaterally he did so anyways under her pressure. And that's
through a consent decree, as I recall.
Through a consent decree. And interestingly, I referred to the phone call that the Georgia delegation had with the Secretary of State in March. We did not know at the time that he had already made the deal with Stacey about 2 weeks before our phone call. It was literally months after
he didn't mention
it. We were made aware of that. He did not mention it, but the deal was already made, and that explains why he was unwilling to budge with us in our phone call. He had already made the deal.
One of several examples of intransigence that he's exhibited in the period since. Congressman, I want to come back to Raffensperger and why you're running against him in a moment. But before we do, one of the upsides, I guess, of the problems that you've just described with respect to the 2020 election is that finally, after it was all over, unfortunately, but nonetheless, finally, the Georgia State Legislature did adopt a new bill, and it was signed into law by Brian Kemp, the governor, that aimed at fixing at least some of the problems that were identified in last year's election cycle. Talk a little bit about that legislation and what's happened since it was adopted by the authorities there in your state.
Yeah, it's really a good bill. It could have been stronger, could have had more in it, but what they focused on was trying to close the gaping holes that were created by our Secretary of State that opened wide the door for fraud. And they've successfully done that. I mean, the voter identification now is a major portion of the bill that was just passed, and it's identification that's associated with driver's license numbers, not with signatures, not with social security numbers. Nobody even knows their driver's license number. This is information that's not publicly accessible. And so they said, listen, the best way to identify who the voter is that they submit their driver's license number, their photo ID with that number, because the Secretary of State has that number on file as well.
But if they don't have a driver's license, obviously other arrangements would be made to enable them to identify themselves with a government
ID. That's correct. 98% of voters in Georgia have a driver's license, even in minority. So 98% are there. So we're only talking 2%, and the state offers free identifications, and then there are other options. All that is laid out in there. So it's really
So this argument that you're disenfranchising people because you're requiring this ID is rubbish.
It's ridiculous. It's nothing but liberal talking points that have no truth in them whatsoever.
And you know, the interesting thing to me, Jody, is that
it's a great bill.
It really has the effect of disenfranchising voters, all right. That's something they claim about your legislation, but it would be disenfranchising legal voters. Because you would be enabling people who, as we saw in the last cycle, weren't actually entitled to vote to do so. That negates the voters who are allowed to vote from casting
exactly right.
Legal ballots.
Jody,
hold your thought, if you would.
100,000 did not vote in the Senate race for that very reason.
That's a key point that we'll return to momentarily. We're going to talk about what's happening in Georgia at this moment, and what it means not only there, but also nationally with legislation that is ominous in the extreme. We'll talk more about that with Representative Jody Heiss, member of the United States Congress from Georgia and candidate for the Secretary of State in that important state, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're speaking with Congressman Jody Heiss of the 10th District of Georgia, a man who has an important role in the Congress overseeing government operations. There's a lot of mischief going on with those operations at the moment, heavens knows. He's also decided to run for the job of Secretary of State in Georgia, which has been in the Klieg lights in the course of the last election cycle, and now what's afoot in Georgia to try to reform problems that were identified in that election season. Congressman Heiss, again, thank you for joining us. Thank you for staying with us. You were just saying that one of the effects of the, well, I call it electoral grand larceny in your state last time around, was to suppress the vote in the Senate runoffs, and that has had very far-reaching effects, needless to say. Talk a little bit about that and the significance of it for voter integrity concerns going forward.
We all know, Frank, that if we lose voter integrity in our system of governance, we lose everything. The voice of the people no longer counts. And that's the bottom line of what happened in Georgia. People felt as though their vote no longer counted. They felt like it was not an election in Georgia where only legal ballots were cast, nor was it an election cycle where only legal ballots were counted. So both on the front end and the back end, people felt though fraud overtook the system. As a result, we literally had hundreds of thousands of voters who voted in the presidential election who did not even show up for the senatorial election because they felt like their vote didn't count. They felt like it did not matter how they voted. The other side was going to find more votes, and so it didn't matter. And as a result, not only did Georgia suffer enormously, but the impact on our entire nation has been indescribable with two of the worst, potentially, arguably, two of the worst senators in American history now coming out of the state of Georgia. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Not one, but two, as they say. And more to the point, the fact that they are there, giving rise to a 50-50 tie in the Senate, which is broken, of course, by the Vice President, Kamala Harris, has meant it's been possible for some of the most egregious legislative initiatives to become law or are in the prospect of being. And I want to talk to you in a moment, Jody, about one of those pieces of legislation that the president spoke to in the House chamber last night, H.R. 1. But before we get there, just to finish up sort of the tableau here, talk a little bit about the response that your state's legislators effort to correct some of the serious problems, obvious problems with the 2020 election process has encountered in the days since its enactment.
Well, we've all seen it, and hats off to the General Assembly for being tough and for not caving in. But we've watched major corporations boycott. Hundreds of corporations have been involved in trying to boycott Georgia, from the movie industry to Coca-Cola to Delta, even the corporations like that are home in Georgia. We've seen Major League Baseball pull out of the All-Star game from Georgia, costing literally an estimated $100 million in lost revenue to the state. And all because they are carrying a false narrative of what this bill does, calling it Jim Crow 2.0. Listen, we have more early voting days than New York, more than Delaware, more than Colorado. I mean, you can name virtually any blue state in this nation. Georgia has more early voting days. We have more opportunities to vote. We have increased voting opportunity and accessibility while decreasing the capacity to cheat.
Yeah, as they say, make it easy to vote, hard to cheat, right? And to your great credit, and it is to the great, I think, discredit of these corporations and, you know, the woke media and so on, that they are engaged in these false narratives. And clearly, one of the reasons that they're doing it is to try not only to engender the repeal of this statute in Georgia, but to prevent other states from following Georgia's lead and fixing problems that have arisen in their election systems. But also, Jody, as I mentioned a moment ago, to try to get this legislation through at the federal level, H.R. 1, as it was called in the House, S.1, as it's now being considered in the Senate. I'd like you to talk a little bit about that bill. Obviously, you did not support it. No Republican did. But what's in it? what would it do, and both to your own state and its constitutional role in election processes, but more broadly, to, you know, our national political system and life?
Yeah, great question. H.R. 1 literally is a federal takeover of the election system in this nation. It would trump every single state law, as those individual states have design their own election system in their various states. And listen, our founders designed this very specifically. They did not want foreign interference. They did not want cheating taking place on the federal level. They did not want ambassadors from other countries coming here and in our capital utilizing bribery or whatever other means they had to influence a federal election out of our capital city.
How prescient of them.
Avoid that. Yeah, they spread it out among all the states, and they said this is going to minimize the potential for cheating and fraud. And, you know, H.R. 1 would reverse all that, bring it back to the federal. It legalizes ballot harvesting. It sends live ballots to everyone on every voter registration file in every state. No voter identification, voter harvesting. I mean,
and precludes cleaning up the rolls, something that you alluded to as a problem. Yeah,
it hinders states from cleaning up the rolls. It ensures Democrats will win from now on. And bottom line, that's what it's a power grab to ensure Democrat victories from here on out.
And we are perilously close to it becoming law because, in part, thanks to those two Georgia senators elected under dubious circumstances that will be enshrined in this law. Let's be clear. You will find if the filibuster has a carve out, it is adopted by the Senate and signed into law by Joe Biden. He made clear he's intent on doing that last night. So, Jody, this provides kind of the backdrop for the ministry that you're proposing to embark upon, namely trying to serve as the Secretary of State in Georgia and ensure that voter integrity, voting integrity, electoral integrity is restored in your state and across this land. How important is it that there be a change in the leadership in your state in this regard?
It's critically important, and for two primary reasons. Number one, we've got to ensure voter integrity in Georgia and voter confidence with the voters that they know without question when they cast a ballot, it's a legal ballot and it will be counted and others will not be counted. I mean, we've got to restore confidence in the election system. But secondly, we've got to have a Secretary of State who will stand up to the federal government as they are trying to push things like H.R. 1 and overtake states' rights and states' abilities to determine their own election laws. And we've got to file lawsuits. We've got to kick back. We've got to push back. We've got to say to the federal government, this is unconstitutional. It's wrong. We're not going to sit back and let you walk over us. This is the state of Georgia, or any other state for that matter. So it's a twofold purpose why I'm in this race, to clean up the state issue and ensure election integrity among the Georgia voters, but then also to set up a barrier to push back against an out of control federal government that is now trying to take over on the federal level states' rights to determine their election process.
Well, you're an experienced political figure in the state. You've campaigned now successfully four times for the Congress. You're, I'm sure, down talking to Georgia voters about your candidacy. What are you hearing from them? Are they now so dispirited by what has happened that you're likely to see a similar kind of outcome to the last election cycle, the runoff election specifically, where they just don't vote in large numbers? Or are people now recognizing the urgency of the kinds of corrective actions you're talking about, Jody Heiss, and prepared to engage again as fully as possible?
Yeah, they really are recognizing the desperate situation that we are in. They understand that if we lose election integrity, we lose everything, not only in Georgia in this case, but across the country. If H.R. 1 is passed, that we have got to ensure the voice of the people to determine their governors, their government in every capacity. And they realized that that was compromised in Georgia. So really, there's a tremendous amount of momentum, and I'm just being unbelievably well received. Of course, President Trump's endorsement has been an amazing boost as well. But there's great momentum and enthusiasm as I'm talking to people all across the state of Georgia. And I just believe people are going to show back up to vote because they understand that this election is going to determine future elections and the integrity thereof. So I'm very well pleased with where we are at this point, early stages of the race, and extremely encouraged with the support and momentum that the people of Georgia are providing us.
Well, congratulations on Donald Trump's endorsement. That's obviously huge. Congratulations on the fact that you're state legislature and governor finally did take steps to try to assure that the next election will be free and fair in Georgia. It, as you say, might have been stronger, but still it's a significant improvement over what went down last time. And here's hoping, Jody Heiss, that we will succeed. We, the American people, will succeed in prevailing on senators not to adopt legislation that would further again compound the problem and the alienation, the discouragement of American voters going forward. That mustn't happen. And again, we appreciate so much your visiting with us about all of this, your leadership in the Congress at the moment, and we wish you well in your efforts to take the fight to Georgia, where it will really make a difference both in that state and for the country. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again very soon if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Speaker Newt Gingrich about America and where it's headed right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say we are joined by the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich. He is these days the driving force behind Gingrich 360, the prolific author of some 40 books, including most recently Trump and the American Future, showing the great problems of our times, and Trump versus China. And we're going to be talking, I'm sure, about both of those. He is also the host of Newt's World, which you can listen to on all of the podcast platforms, and you can follow him as I do, at Newt Gingrich. Mr. Speaker, it's so good to have you back at Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Well, listen, I'm delighted to join you, and as always, your work on trying to protect America is just remarkably important.
Well, I appreciate that greatly. Let me ask you about your work, sir. We have been confronting since last November's election, a whole series of challenges. We spent the previous two segments talking with one of your former colleagues, Jody Heiss, also from Georgia, of course, about the challenges of electoral problems. So I'm going to address, if I may, the sort of larger geostrategic problems of the time. You've characterized them as extant both on the domestic and the foreign policy sides. And maybe we could start with sort of the thesis of one of your recent pieces about Biden's first 100 days. It was kind of showcased in his remarks to, some of the Congress last night. I call it the free stuff speech. What did you make of it, Mr. Speaker? And what does it say about the sort of domestic policy agenda of the Biden-Harris team?
Well, I think last night was, frankly, where it mattered was incoherent. I thought there was something almost tragic about tuning into an American president who is talking to a room that is virtually empty. One of the reasons you never saw any great momentum build up is you can't space people that far apart and expect them to have energy. So the very vacancy of the room undercut his speech. And I couldn't help thinking, you know, you're Putin or you're Xi Jinping, and you're watching this and thinking to yourself, how weak and how frightened are the Americans that they would put this on TV and that they would let us see that they can't even figure out how to get their Congress together. And I thought it was, in that sense, symbolically, a really dangerous signal to the world. I also think if you looked at the speech itself, you know, there's a reason that AOC says that she and her friends have been delighted at how radical Biden has been, that he's been a pleasant surprise. and it poses the question, if Biden occupies the space that used to be the radicals, how far to the left do the radicals have to go to regain their claim to be radical? And I think you're going to see, sort of much like the French Revolution, you're going to see a continued race to the left. And whatever Biden does will be a prelude to the next terrible thing.
Yeah, well, and the potential for that becoming a lurch into the violent radical left is very present as well, of course, as you know. But maybe just staying with the agenda that the president laid out last night on the domestic side, is it fair to characterize it as, well, socialist, I think is the most charitable way, maybe even Marxist in its character in terms of government domination of every sector of our lives and increasingly involved in dictating their character and their trajectory?
Well, I think as he described to you, his desire to expand free government schooling, which the teachers union would love because it's a jobs program, the degree to which they are looking at, I think, a really challenging moment here. Basically, I tweeted out yesterday that this would really be the American welfare speech, and that this is a major step towards creating a dependency society and crushing the opportunity society. And essentially, it reflects their desire that government do everything. But I don't know of any European semi-socialist country which has more inducements to rely on the government than the Biden plan. And I mean, the amount of money they've proposed spending already is so staggering. It virtually guarantees inflation. And I think it virtually guarantees that you know, you're going to see the weakening of the dollar, and you're going to see, very much like Jimmy Carter, you're going to see a whole new cycle here, I think, of the economy. The great problem will not be unemployment in the short run. The great problem will become, I think, this whole question of what do you do with an economy where gasoline goes up, housing goes up, groceries go up, and people begin to realize that they just can't afford Joe Biden's version of reality.
Yeah, this would be particularly true if, and you're a big thinker by well-reserved reputation, this would be particularly true if the impact of all of this is, as you say, on the weakening of the dollar to the point where the Chinese communists are successful in their longstanding objective of displacing the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Would it not? Talk a little bit about what the implications of that might be for our economy as well as our society.
We've had an enormous advantage because the entire world relies on the American dollar as a currency, and in a sense, that gives us an ability to do things that really does put us in a unique position. The British were in this position for about 150 years. And as they lost their economic capabilities, it transitioned over to us. And people don't appreciate how much being the world reserve currency means in terms of your own ability to be the master of your economy, because people all over the planet want dollars. So there's a permanent market for the U.S. right now. If that collapses, and I'm not sure that in the first phase that the Chinese will necessarily replace it so much as it'll just become chaos. And you'll have three or four or five currencies that are, you know, sort of pushing around, shoving around. I mean, at one point, for example, the Swiss franc was a probably the strongest currency in the world and the most reliable currency. Well, if we get to a point where people decide they don't want dollars because they don't trust the American government, we have a really big problem at that stage. And it will both raise our interest rates and dramatically limit the choices that government officials can make.
Yeah. Weimar Germany with wheelbarrows full of cash comes to mind as a particularly horrific end state. But whether we get there quickly or over time remains to be seen. But it seems as though that's the trajectory all of this wild government spending would take us to. Let me ask you, sir, before we break, about one other piece of the domestic situation we find ourselves in under the Biden-Harris policy approach, and that is the border crisis and the seeming explanation for it that they are trying permanently to change the electorate of the United States so as to guarantee essentially a one-party polity. Is that what's afoot here, and what are the security as well as the political implications?
Well, look, I think that what you're really looking at is an enormous crisis for the, I think, for the United States. And I think you have to start from there and realize that this administration will do almost nothing for a practical reason. It's not a crisis on the border for them. They want illegal immigrants. Remember that when they were campaigning, most of the Democratic candidates for president favored totally open borders. So what you're getting is, in the first 3 months of the year, we had more people cross the border than in all of 2020. It's continuing to accelerate. So my guess is we'll probably have five times as many people cross the border illegally this year as did in 2020. It might be as much as six or seven times. Because as word gets out, you know, and you got it from Biden in his own statement last night, where he said basically, why don't we make it easy for people who have overstayed their visa to become citizens? Well, what that says to me, you know, you're sitting out here in Guatemala or El Salvador, you're thinking, boy, if I could get a visa and then I could overstay and then I could become an American citizen. And you have Democrats in New York who passed a law which provides $15,000. Think about that. $15,000 for every illegal immigrant who gets COVID. That's more, by the way, than any American gets. So these are the kind of things that you have to be aware of.
He actually said, as I recall, farm workers could be put on a path to citizenship as well. I mean, this really is a sort of y'all come signal, isn't it, to flood the border and intensify the kinds of challenges that we're having there at the moment. Which brings me to another one, and you're talking about a crisis of American civilization arising from the enemy within as well as without. We'll talk in a moment about the without, but just very quickly, sir, how would you characterize the sort of socialist revolution or communist revolution, even Marxists in the streets of America at the moment?
Well, I think it's a sign of the total collapse of the American establishment. People are no longer willing to defend the rule of law. They're no longer willing to insist on nonviolence. And, you know, you go to a place like Portland, it's astonishing the total scale that we've seen in Portland of violence for well over a year and a half now. Every single night there's violence. And nobody has the nerve or the will to stop it, which can be done pretty quickly if you're serious about it. But in New York a weekend ago, you had 55 people shot. You know, that's more than
this is evidence of a massive problem. We're going to talk about the compounding of that problem by what the foreign policy of this administration is signaling to the world. An America Last foreign policy, our guest has called it. We'll talk about that and much more with Speaker Newt Gingrich right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are continuing an extraordinarily timely and important conversation with one of the big thinkers in our country, a practitioner as well, the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. You can follow what he does, which is vitally important, at Gingrich360.com. That's Gingrich360.com. Mr. Speaker, again, thank you so much for joining us today. When we talk about an America Last presidency, that obviously stands in stark contrast to his predecessor's America First policy. You have thought long and hard. You've written extensively. You've warned assiduously about one of the most serious challenges this country has ever faced, arguably the most serious foreign national security and economic security challenge we've ever faced, namely that posed by the Chinese Communist Party. Talk a little bit about this, if you would, against the backdrop of, what seems to be sort of a reflexive, nostalgia that Joe Biden defaults to, including in the speech last night about his relationship with Xi Jinping and what that is suggesting about the policies that he's pursuing with regard to China.
Well, I think he's caught in a vice right now. Everything in his career was pro-Chinese. His speeches, he went to China to give speeches that were totally pro-Chinese. His attitude was pro-Chinese. Many of his biggest backers are people who do business in China and have made a lot of money out of China.
And then there's his son.
But what's happened is, then there's Hunter, which is a different kind of story. But then you get to people like yourself who have been warning about the Chinese Communist Party's dictatorship. Its aggressiveness, its modernization, its desire to crowd us out as the dominant country in the world. And what's happened, I think, that what I took from last night is that his pollsters have looked at all this and said, you've got to sound tough on China, because over 70% of the American people now are very worried about the Chinese and take very seriously the Chinese threat to the United States. And so you had this kind of mixed message. On the one hand, here's my good friend Xi Jinping. I've traveled 17,000 miles with him. We talked for 2 hours when I got elected. But boy, I told him how tough I was going to be. Well, first of all, if you watch the delivery last night, do you really think that Joe Biden could deliver a tough message? I mean, it's just not who he is.
Especially given how compromised he is by the Chinese, I fear.
Right. I don't think he could be tough with Argentina. I don't think that Joe Biden has the kind of leadership toughness that you see. Even in a guy like Obama, there was a sort of an egocentric toughness that came from his contempt for most of the world. But with Biden, you have a guy who I suspect deep down is amazed that he's standing there.
There are a lot of us who feel that way. But there it is.
That's right. The danger for America is simple. Biden's strongest allies are the teachers' union. The teachers' union policies guarantee that the Chinese will win. The Chinese have no better ally than the teachers' union, because what they're doing to our children is just devastating. The Chinese are learning math, where in Virginia, for example, they're actually going to eliminate the advanced math courses because people who are African-American aren't doing well in them. And so the answer is to dumb down the entire system rather than to provide tutors and help the kids learn how to do math. It's astonishing.
And it does seem as though there's a fair number of them that are out and out Marxists on top of everything else. So that indoctrination is not an accident, comrade, as they like to say. So, Newt, just quickly, when you look at the Chinese threat, whether it's the Chinese Communist Party virus, as I think it's properly called, that has killed 500,000 of us and more now, and done devastation around the world, whether it's the extent to which they have been engaged in horrific crimes against humanity at home and abroad, notably what they're doing to Christians and Uyghurs, or the distinct threat that they are increasingly representing militarily to us and to friends and allies and vital interests of this country, notably Taiwan, but not confined to that. If we don't have either the toughness or an administration populated by people who even really grasp the magnitude of the danger, is it enough that the American people, 70% of them, as you say, are concerned about this? Or must we actually retool what we're doing at the policy level by this administration?
Well, I think we have to retool at every level. We have to reform our schools, which we first were warned about by the Reagan administration in 1983. We have to, I think, be much tougher on Chinese infiltration of our society. We have to, I think, adopt rules and tax policy and regulatory policy that minimizes the evolution of jobs to China and maximizes insourcing them back to the U.S. And we have to fundamentally, profoundly overhaul the Pentagon. I thought the most interesting comment Biden made last night was about the notion that the scale of innovation in the next decade will be so dramatically bigger than we've seen. And you look at the Pentagon procurement system, there's no possibility that they can keep up with that without very, very deep, dramatic reform. So I think there are a lot of things all of us have to roll up our sleeves and do. I still have enormous faith in a free people, but I think that our bureaucratic institutions and interest groups are really putting us very close to the edge of being in serious danger of losing.
One other piece of this, which you have, to your great credits, are focused on, and I know, believe is essential to these sorts of corrective actions, is that we must stop underwriting the Chinese Communist Party and its various predations, whether they're environmental or whether they're, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative or this military buildup or, you know, crimes against humanity, what have you. How vital is it that we get that right? And do you see signs that we're starting to discourage Wall Street from continuing to put our pension funds and 401ks and so on into communist China for its benefit and our detriment?
Well, I would say, first of all, that Roger Robinson, who played a substantial role in the economic policies of the Reagan administration in undermining and defeating the Soviet Union, has just done remarkable work on this whole question of access to capital. And Roger points out rightly that the system right now is so perverted in the direction of helping the Chinese that Chinese companies can skip all sorts of checks and balances that are built into the system to protect Americans from being defrauded. And what we discovered, though, in working with Roger over the last couple of years is there are big, powerful interest groups that are making so much money in China that they couldn't care less about the national interest. They really are committed to making the money in China. Well, I mean, you get the same thing. The fact that in making the new version of Top Gun, they took the Taiwan label off of his fighter pilot jacket in order to be able to show it in China, or the degree to which the NBA has kowtowed to the Chinese, to use an old Chinese term. Every time you turn around, it turns out that red, white, and blue is not nearly as important as green to a lot of these people. And, you know, that means they have to undermine their own country. As long as they get a good quarterly profit, they'll do it.
Mr. Speaker, let me ask you about one last item in the foreign policy agenda, which is deeply troubling. Another place where it seems that the principal impetus is not Trump, or maybe Obama 3.0, namely Iran. We're watching this administration appease the Iranians and undermine our Israeli friends and allies, our friends and allies such as they are in the Gulf as well. What must be done to prevent this from leading inevitably to a nuclear weapon in the hands of arguably the most dangerous regime on the planet?
Well, I mean, what we should be doing, of course, is actively working to replace the dictatorship, because as long as they're in charge, Iran is going to be an enormous threat. And I think in some ways, because of their religious beliefs and the intensity of their willingness to have a cataclysmic battle as part of their religious tradition, they may well be the most dangerous in terms of likelihood of actually starting something. The current administration, of course, has John Kerry back in it. Kerry, as the Secretary of State, was a total disaster under Obama. Seems to have no common sense, no understanding of the real world, and cannot distinguish between our allies and our enemies, except that he instinctively likes our enemies more, which I think is probably a function that they go to 4-star dinner restaurants and our allies tend to go to 2-star restaurants. So Kerry, who is an elegant member of the elite, much prefers people who have an appropriate opportunity to dine.
Of course. You know, it does seem to me that is the leitmotif of this administration, that it's better to be an enemy of the United States than a friend. And that way, obviously, is extraordinarily perilous. Mr. Speaker, I know we have to let you go. I appreciate so much your visit with us. I hope it'll be one of many soon, as this is vital to hear your voice amplified wherever we can. And thanks for what you do at Gingrich360.com and on Fox News and your other various platforms. But I hope you'll feel free to make
it's always great talking to you. And you're one of the warriors who's helped us survive as a free country. So I'm always honored to be with you.
Thank you. Bless you, sir. We'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.